Welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm Tom Williams, and you're not hearing the voice of Brian Earle. He's vacationing. I think he's in Oregon. Sounds like he's having a ball. I'd rather be there, but he's there and having fun, and so I'm sitting in for him today. And we welcome in Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Coming up at the end of the program, we'll have another Petals and Prose segment from Helen Cannon. We're looking forward to that. But we'll jump in here with your questions. We'd love to have your questions at upraccess@gmail.com. Use that address today, upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can call us at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. So, Mark, at the store, is there any time of year that's especially busy? Is this a busy time of year?
You know, there's a lot to do, but with the kids getting back into school and everyone getting back into their routine, it kind of slows down a little bit, but there's a lot of exciting things that you can do in the fall, whether it's planting garlic, whether it's planting some fall crops, some cold crops that will do really well this time of year. And of course, tulip bulbs and daffodils are starting to come in. And there's a lot to do just to harvest whatever you've been growing all summer, get the lawn back in shape after such a hot, dry summer. There's a lot we can do to really get the yard and the lawn perked back up and get things looking good for fall.
So I'm a rookie gardener. I've grown maybe one garden myself. Well, with my wife, I'm a little surprised to hear I can plant some things right now that I can harvest even in cold northern Utah.
Absolutely. So right now we've got a lot of things that are just finishing up their harvest season. So a lot of beans are done, and we've got all the cold crops from the earlier spring are gone. So we've got peas, spinach, lettuce, radishes that everyone has harvested, and they're pretty much done. We're harvesting carrots and beets like crazy right now, and squashes and tomatoes and cucumbers and everything. But there's always seems to be a little bit of space left in the garden. Say the corn's all done and you've cut that all down and you've got a big empty spot. What can you do with it right now? You can replant lettuces and kale and spinach and a lot of these leafy greens and have those producing in October and even into the first part of November if the weather holds out, and be harvesting those through the fall. So all those cold weather crops that we planted very early this spring, in March and April, that can handle the cold in the springtime, they can handle the cold in the fall just as well. So a lot of those greens, it's nice to have those fresh greens coming out of the garden, especially in October and November when things are kind of winding down.
So northern Utah, early November, depending on the weather, is sort of a deadline, I guess, to harvest.
Yeah. Cache Valley, our first frost in the fall usually is around the 20th, 25th of September. And as hot as it's been, I'd be surprised if it were that early, but you never know. But I would suspect it'll probably be towards the end of this month. And then ground will kind of start to freeze towards the middle part of November. That's kind of when things really start to slow down. So if we plant some of those lettuces and spinach and beet greens and kale and collards and mustards and all that fun stuff you can harvest and eat fresh right out of the garden through the fall, it will start producing in probably about 40, 45 days, it'll be ready to pick. So about mid-October, and you can probably harvest that for 3 or 4 weeks, maybe even a little bit longer, depending on how our weather holds out.
Mm. So let's talk about planting you can do in the autumn, continue that. I think you can plant perennials.
Absolutely, yeah. So a lot of planting, not just in our vegetable garden, but we can plant perennials. In fact, it's a very good time to divide and move your perennials if you need to. If they've become overgrown over the last 3 or 4 years and they're getting a little bit too large, you can dig those up in the fall. September, early October would be a great time to do that. Divide those plants and then move those to new locations or share some with some neighbors or some friends. And because they multiply and they gather a lot of size. And so sometimes we've got to thin those out and get them back down into a more manageable size. So perennials, great time to plant those. There's some nice fall blooming perennials that are coming in right now. So we've got fall blooming mums. We've got asters that are in full bloom that look great. And there's a lot of blooming shrubs that are late bloomers as well too. So actually at the store right now, I've got a crepe myrtle, which is really kind of a Midwestern southern plant, but they're starting to breed some that are a little bit more tolerant of our cold temperatures. Mm-hmm. And so a little bit smaller. The crepe myrtles are gorgeous. And they bloom for long time through the summer. And so I've got just a couple of those. Rose of Sharon bloom nicely through the fall. So there's some great fall blooming shrubs that are available. And of course, a lot of very colorful shrubs in the fall as well, too. Burning bush is one that, of course, jumps to mind because they will just turn bright red in the fall. And there's a lot of great colorful shrubs that you can accent your garden and your yard with a little bit of color in the fall, not from flowers, but from the foliage itself as well. So dogwoods are great. There's some nice colorful dogwoods, cotoneasters, you know, Peking cotoneasters, lots of burgundies and reds and oranges and a lot of great colors to add to your garden in the fall.
You know, my wife and I have been, well, my wife has been doing the work, but we've taken out a bunch of ground cover in our front yard.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to plan what to put in there.
Sure.
I'm wondering, we've had some perennials in there. We've taken some of those out. Perennials versus annuals, and what kind of? And there's another part of our yard where we just want some good ground cover.
Yeah.
To kind of choke out the weeds and make it look nice.
Yeah, and there's a lot of very nice ground covers you can do. Of course, got to identify whether you have a full sun, partial shade, or a full shady area, because there are some perennials and also ground covers that will do better depending on what kind of light exposure that they're getting, and lots of different ones to choose from. Normally we carry probably 40, 50 different kinds of ground covers that perform in a wide range of conditions, and so there's some great ones for shade, there's some great ones for full sun, and a lot that will bloom for 3-4 weeks during the summer, so you get nice color out of those as well too. But great thing about ground covers is it's kind of like a domesticated weed. They just spread all over the place, and so they cover a large area in a short amount of time, fairly inexpensively, and low maintenance. I mean, you hardly have to do anything to them. They kind of choke a lot of the weeds out, but since they are aggressive, you've got to contain them or else they will become weeds in other parts of your garden. So that's definitely a concern. But the nice thing about some of the developments in a lot of the perennials the last few years is a lot of the perennial flowers, of course, their flowers are beautiful. They only last for 2 or 3 weeks, so you're not going to get a great show of flower production out of most of your perennials. They will come on at specific times, and so you have to plan your garden accordingly so that you have different perennials blooming at different times. Otherwise, you just don't have anything in bloom. But the last, I'd say, 5 or 10 years, a lot of perennials have been developed for their foliage instead of just for their flowers. And a lot of these foliage plants have very vibrant, very colorful, very attractive and eye-catching foliage. I mean, the leaves are just beautiful. And so whether they're in bloom or not, it doesn't really matter because you're planting them for their foliage instead of for the flowers, because the flower season is so short on a lot of these perennials, less than a month. And you've got them in leaf from, you know, April all the way through October. If you can get color out of the foliage instead of out of the flowers, then that makes them much more attractive in your garden. So we've got coral bells, you know, a heuchera, and just tons of great colors. So you've got a range of chocolate colors to burgundy colors to peach colors to limes and a lot of different greens. So there's a really great palette of color to choose from in the heuchera family. And you've got tiarellas, and of course you've got hostas and ferns, and, you know, a lot of different plants that are very, very attractive just for their foliage.
What if we want to cut back on water usage? Are there some plants that we could plant or arrangements that we could make that would cut back on water?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of plants that naturally have a lot of water tolerance and drought tolerance built into them. We just water them too much. So we've got them in our planting areas, and we water them with sprinklers. And if we were to swap some of those sprinkler heads out and put a drip system or put a soaker hose in instead, we could use 70 to probably 90% less water and still end up with the same job, with the same plants that we've got. And in many cases, if we've got a lot of mulch down, you know, a weed barrier type product, you know, so the weed fabric that keeps a lot of the weeds down in and around our landscaped areas. You know, it's very common to put down a landscape fabric and then put bark or decorative gravel or lava rock or something over the top of it to help keep those weeds down and make the ground a little bit more attractive. That actually helps hold a lot of moisture. And a lot of times, especially even this year, people have had to water so much because it's been hot, but in many cases they're watering and the soil's already moist, and it doesn't need to be watered when the soil is still moist. So a lot of times we really need to get out there and physically check the conditions of our soil, especially if we have a mulch down, because you can look at it and say, oh, mulch is dry, needs to be watered. Well, you go down 2 inches and it's moist and wet underneath still, doesn't need that extra water. We're just wasting water. And so it's really up to the homeowner and the gardener to get out there, stick their fingers in the dirt, find out how deep the moisture actually really goes. And depending on soil type, you know, if you've got a little bit more clay, you've got a nice sandy loam soil, it's going to hold moisture longer than if you have a gravelly, really sandy soil. It's going to drain through a lot quicker. And so a lot of times you can go once a week, once even every 10 days with a deep watering. And a lot of these gardeners, a lot of these homeowners are watering 3 times a week. Instead. So we could cut our watering back 50% just by getting out there and checking how the soil conditions are. And if it's still moist, it doesn't need to be watered. You can go another 2, maybe 3 days before they have to be watered again. But a lot of times we just let the sprinkler system take care of it, and it comes on a couple times a week for the lawn. So we might as well just water the shrubs and trees while we're at it. And in many cases, they don't need it.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brian Earle is away. He's vacationing. Tom Williams in for him. And we're talking with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. So far, we've been taking care of my yard, which is was great. We'll just continue with this, but we'd love to take care of your yard and garden as well. Your question to today, upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com, or you can call 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. And later in the program, we'll have a Petals and Prose segment from Helen Cannon. So more things that you can plant in the fall, trees and shrubs. So there's some good species you can plant in the fall.
Yeah. So the trick with planting in the fall is a lot of your availability is gone. You know, throughout the spring and summer, a lot of those trees have been kind of plucked up and planted already. And so you don't have quite as good a selection through the fall as you do, say, early on in the spring when the plants are really just starting to arrive. But from now until the ground freezes in November is as good a time to plant as any. I mean, if you've got an empty spot, you need a tree or a couple shrubs to just kind of, you know, accentuate your yard a little bit. Fall is prime time for planting shrubs and trees and perennials. Bulbs, of course. We've got tulip bulbs and daffodils that are starting to come in, and those are fall planted, and they bloom in the spring. So a lot of people, they'll come in the springtime, they'll say, oh, my neighbor's got all these beautiful, you know, tulips that are starting to come up and daffodils, and I want to plant some too. It's like, well, see you in September and October, because that's when they really come in. So if you enjoyed tulips and daffodils and hyacinths and crocus this spring, you want to plant them this fall. They need that time in the ground to develop a root system and to develop a flower bud through the wintertime. So they need that cold weather through the winter to develop the root system that it needs and to develop that flower bud. And then you get to enjoy those flowers in the springtime. And so they've got to be planted in the fall. Probably the best time to plant is through the latter part of September into the first part of November before the ground freezes for sure. And those bulbs will be arriving from Holland probably this week. There's a good possibility they might be here today or even tomorrow. So we're kind of expecting those bulbs to show up. And huge selection of tulips. We usually stock about 70 different varieties of tulips. So a lot of different colors, a lot of different bloom times. So you can have some blooming early on in April, have some blooming in late April, and have some blooming in mid-May. And the nice thing about tulips and daffodils is the flowers last about 3 weeks or so, depending on how hot it gets in the springtime. If it's nice and cool and mild weather, they'll last for even 4 weeks or longer. But if it turns really hot, probably 2 weeks, 3 weeks max is what you're going to get out of them. But such a showy, you know, beautiful color in the springtime when there's really not a lot going on. So planning ahead with bulbs and trying to add some color to your yard in the future by planting those bulbs in the fall is a great way to have splashes of color all over your yard in the springtime.
So those, the tulip bulbs, the all or most still come from Holland? Is that the...
You know what? There's a lot that are developed and grown in the Northwest. And so we see some that come out of Washington and Oregon, but conditions are perfect in Holland for bulb growing. So the majority of all the bulbs are imported from Holland, and they're really the best ones. Mm. You know, not to knock our domestic ones. I mean, they're good, but there's just something about the conditions that they've got there in Holland that's just perfect for tulips and daffodils. So when you're selecting your bulbs, you want the largest bulbs you can find. The bigger the bulb, the bigger the flowers are going to be. So the size of the bulb is directly related to the size of the flower, and in most cases, the quality of the flower as well, too. So larger daffodil bulbs will translate into more and larger flowers on your daffodil. Same with the tulip, same with the hyacinth. So we always try and bring in the largest bulbs that we can find. And of course, they're a little bit more expensive than the ones you'd say find at Lowe's or Home Depot or Walmart. But in many cases, the size of the bulb is 50% or much more larger than the ones that you're buying. Higher quality, we've got better storage conditions, and they just perform better. If you plant small bulbs, you're going to get small flowers, and they're going to not last as long. And with the larger bulbs, they'll actually increase in size over time and multiply. And bulbs are an investment. They don't just bloom and they're done. You've got them for years afterwards, and they'll multiply. They'll increase. A little bit of maintenance to dig those up occasionally from, maybe every 2 or 3 years to try and split those and divide those, replant them, fertilize them, mend the soil a little bit. But for the most part, it's dig your hole, drop the bulb in, throw a little fertilizer in with it, cover it up, you're done. Hmm. That's it. I mean, so for someone who's, you're saying, Tom, that you're not an experienced gardener,
right.
Bulbs are right down your alley.
I could plant bulbs.
Yeah, because
okay,
seriously,
I'll do that.
All you got to do is dig your hole, put a little fertilizer in the bottom, drop your bulb in, cover it up, water it. Mm-hmm. Mother Nature takes care of the rest.
Yeah.
I mean, it is seriously that simple. And there's a great webpage that the Holland Bulb Growers Association has put together, and it's got information about all the bulbs, how to plant, but it also has companion planting on how to add perennials into your flowers, and there's lots of different templates and planting guides on how to incorporate different flowers in with your perennials. And there's a ton of information. It's a great resource, and if you have any interest in planting bulbs, or if you're an avid gardener, you really got to check this webpage out. It's called Dig Drop Done.
DigDropDone.com. Okay.
And it's put together by the Holland Bulb Growers Association, and it's a great webpage. Just tons of very, very good information. And the neat thing is it's the association that does it, and so there's no one company that's more prominent than another, and so they've all pooled all of their information, all their resources to promote bulbs just in general. And so it's not really profiting any one corporation or anything. They're just promoting the ease and the simplicity and the greatness of bulbs. Mm. and how great they are out in the garden. So
I'd put some fertilizer in, I'd drop it to cover. What about watering during the fall before we get to winter time?
For bulbs, you definitely need to water them after you get them planted. And if they don't have that good soil moisture as the ground freezes, they will dry up through the wintertime. You'll have problems. With shrubs and trees, as temperatures start to cool down, and my fingers and toes are crossed that it's going to cool down just a little bit. We don't want it to get too cold, but a 15-degree drop in temperature, high 70s,
would be nice.
Low 80s would be very, very nice, at least for another month. As the temperatures cool down, we can start cutting back our water, but we want to maintain good soil moisture through the fall. We have experienced in years past, in this last decade, we've experienced some very, very dry fall weather, and also periods of very dry winter weather as well, where ground freezes in November. We don't get much snow in December. We don't get much snow in January. And then we really kind of start to get snow in February and March. And, as that ground is frozen, the moisture doesn't penetrate in. The snow just kind of sits on top and blows around all winter, and it doesn't ever really penetrate in. And so if the soil is dry when that ground freezes and we don't get much snow cover that melts in December and penetrates into the soil, you have dry plants for up to 4 or 5 months. I mean, you can go October, November, December, January without much moisture. I mean, that's 4 months without any moisture that even though the plants aren't growing, they still need that moisture to survive through the wintertime. And so we will see a lot of fall and winter stress on plants in the springtime because they didn't get any moisture through the fall and the winter. So every 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks at the most, you need to give those plants all the way through October and even through the first part of November, give them a drink of water from time to time if we're not getting good precipitation. If we're not getting good rainstorms, if we're not getting little snowstorms that melt off that we usually get, you know, starting in late October, early November, we'll get a little snowstorm, melts, you know, a couple, you know, day or two later, that moisture penetrates down in the soil. If we're not getting those types of storms that's actually saturating the soil, you need to get out there and water those shrubs and trees occasionally. We're not saying twice a week or saying once every 2 weeks or so just to keep that soil moisture up. And same thing with the lawn. You know, the lawn needs that little bit of moisture. I know a lot of times the weatherman on TV will say, oh, you know, first October, turn off the sprinklers. We're done. Don't water your lawn anymore. It doesn't need it. It needs it. It does not need a lot, but it needs it occasionally. So every 2 or 3 weeks until, you know, the ground really freezes up, it's a good idea to give your lawn a little bit of water and definitely your trees and shrubs.
We're talking with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. Zesty Garden is the name of the program. I'm Tom Williams sitting in for Brian Earle, who's enjoying his vacation. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about weed control. Best time of day to spray, types of weed killers. That's an ongoing project. Yeah. Any time of year. We'll talk about fall weed control when we come back.
Add some fresh color to your landscape with Mums and Asters. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Set them in a decorative pot and place them on your front steps to welcome visitors. Or use them on your patio, deck, or balcony for a bit of color to enjoy all fall. Combine with other fall favorites like ornamental grasses, cabbage, kale, mustard, and pansies for greater impact. Or use them to replace fading annuals or fill in voids in the garden. Leave the mum in its pot and sink it into the ground when using these plants as annuals in the fall garden. You'll need to water less, and it'll be easier to remove and replace with new plantings. And if you're trying to grow them as perennials and tired of replacing fall-planted mums and asters every year, try starting in spring. Purchase and plant them in spring and keep pinching them back to 6 inches throughout early summer. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Extension 4-H and youth programs, assisting youth in acquiring knowledge, building character, and developing life skills in a learning environment. Information at utah4h.org.
Thanks for listening to The Zesty Garden. Tom Williams in for Brian Earle, who's enjoying his vacation, and he'll come back rested and ready next time.
Let's hope so.
Let's hope so. Yeah, it sounds like he's really enjoying a nice vacation, so good for him. We're with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. We're talking about plants you can plant in the fall, and we're going to get into taking care of your lawn, especially fall weed control. And anything that you'd like to talk about, the number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Another about 12 or 13 minutes with Mark Anderson. And then we have a Petals and Pros segment with Helen Cannon. And the email address today is upraxis@gmail.com. Excuse me, upraxis@gmail.com. So weeds are with us, I guess, most times of the year. I guess wintertime, yeah. When we have the snow covered, don't have to worry much about it. But it's been a very hot summer. You were telling me that it's been especially bad with weeds.
Yes. The heat and the weeds have just been very, very complimentary this year, we'll put it that way. So it's just made the weeds grow like crazy. So it seems like every other gardener that I talk to that comes in the store, they've got morning glory in their lawn, or they've got crabgrass and spurge taking over, or they've got, you know, a myriad of different weeds that have just infiltrated their lawn and have taken over this year. And fall's the best time to control weeds, believe it or not. Most everybody, you know, applies an herbicide to their lawn in the spring to try and knock the dandelions down when they're starting to bloom. But fall's really the most important and also the most effective time to spray. As the temperatures cool down, the weeds are noticing that the days are getting shorter. They're noticing that the nights are getting cooler, and they're starting to stockpile a little bit of energy for wintertime. So they're running that nutrient and that energy down into the root system to store for the wintertime. Well, when you use an herbicide to knock those weeds down with, they pick up that herbicide, they think it's fertilizer, and they run it right down the root system, kills the whole plant out. So for difficult weeds in your lawn, weed-free zone is probably the best herbicide that we've ever used. It won't damage grass, kills everything else. It kills morning glory, wild violets, thistles, mallow, clover, dandelions, just all the hardest to kill weeds, and does it very quickly and very effectively, and it biodegrades out of your soil in about 7 to 10 days. And so it's quick to leave after it does its job, so you don't have to worry about a lot of pesticide residues in your soil. Very, very effective herbicide for pretty much all the weeds. The trick is once you get a lot of those weeds under control, then you have bare areas that are open and inviting to more seeds to germinate. Mm-hmm. So what a lot of gardeners and homeowners don't do is after they control a lot of weeds, best thing to do is to overseed with a little bit of new grass seed so that they can fill in those spots. Because if those spots are still bare, weeds are going to take over if there's not something else growing there. And so the trick is to put some new seed out there. And overseeding is a great way to fix a lot of problems, whether you've got bare spots, whether you've got insect damage that has occurred through the year, whether you've got diseases that are causing problems with your lawn, or stress, or you just don't want to water as much. A lot of these newer varieties of grass are very soft, very green. They don't need as much water. I mean, they're much more drought tolerant, and they resist insects better. They resist diseases better. They fill in and then spread out faster, stay that nice dark green even with less water, and they just look great. They perform much better. I mean, think about all the homes in Cache Valley and even throughout the Intermountain West that have been constructed over the last 50 years. Most of those homes have older varieties of grass in them. Unless you've built your house in the last 5 years, a lot of these varieties of grass, you've got just a standard Kentucky bluegrass. You know, like Marion bluegrass is really popular for a long time through the 70s and the early 80s. And I even have people come in and ask for it still. But a lot of these newer breeds of grass are just so much more tolerant of all kinds of different conditions, and the insects don't like them as much. And by incorporating these newer varieties of grass into your lawn, they will start to take over your older grass, and you won't have as many insect problems. You won't have as many disease problems. You won't have to water as much. You can handle more shade or more sun, depending on what your conditions are. And by putting these grass seeds out there right now, they're going to germinate in 7 to 10 days. You're going to have all new grass coming up in with your existing old grass within just a couple weeks, and you'll start to see the difference. I mean, almost immediately next year, and you'll see that much of a difference in how your grass performs over years past.
What about if the lawn's just a mess? You want to just start over? What to do then?
Yeah, from the first part of September through probably the second week of October is the best time of year to plant grass. The soil's warm. Daytime temperatures are fairly warm and consistent. We start to get some moisture that starts popping up, so you don't have to water as much. And the air temperature's cooler, and so you don't have to water nearly as much to keep the grass seed moist. And so you can get grass seed to germinate the fastest possible, in the shortest possible time this time of year by planting. And there's just really no better time of year than in this first part of September through the first part of October to get that grass planted and going. So got to take advantage of it. Mm. And like I said, there's so many good new varieties out there that there's really no reason why you shouldn't be incorporating these great new varieties of grass in there to save work and to save time and to save water in the long run. And a lot of people are aerating and power raking in the fall, too. It's really the best time to power rake and to aerate. And that's also an amazing time to plant grass, because it pulls those plugs out of the soil, opens up the soil. And if you don't put some seed in there, you'll have weeds popping up. Mm. So after aeration, you really want to throw some seed out there to have new seed filling in those spots instead of letting weeds take over.
So even if I don't have bald spots or problem spots, no, I could take advantage of this to overseed?
And like the question you asked about completely starting all over, this is also a very good time to have a short turnaround from killing your grass out. So you've got just a lawn that's just really old and has problems and isn't performing very well. And you just want to get rid of it and start over from scratch. You know, you can spray it with Roundup or Super Kills All. Have it dead in a week or 10 days completely. Mow it down as close as you possibly can. You know, just scalp it as short as you can. Maybe bring just a little bit of topsoil in just to go over the top of that that dead grass mat. You don't have to till it or anything. I mean, this is a fairly, not labor intensive. I mean, it's not a whole lot of work. I mean, once you've sprayed it, get it killed, just bring a little bit of soil in, go over the top of that dead grass, and you can seed right over the top of your existing dead turf. And within a couple of weeks, have new grass coming back already in those areas. So
interesting.
Fairly easy to do. And if you're overseeding an existing lawn, you do pretty much the same thing, except you don't kill your grass. We don't want to kill it. We want to just mow it down really close, scalp it, broadcast that new seed over the top of it, rake it lightly with a leaf rake just to brush the existing grass to get that grass seed to drop down in, make contact with the soil. And then once you get it planted, whether you're starting from scratch or whether you're overseeding, you want to water just a little bit, maybe 3 to 5 minutes twice a day, maybe three times a day, just to keep that soil and that seed moist for about 2 weeks. And all of a sudden you'll have all new grass just popping up like crazy.
Hmm.
Yeah.
When we first bought our home, my wife and I, it was all grass in the back.
Yeah.
We wanted a section for garden, so I sprayed Roundup on a section. And I don't know, I just took a perverse pleasure in that lawn dying. I don't know if that makes me a bad human being, but
yeah.
You can understand that with weeds, but this was a healthy lawn that we just wanted to purpose for another purpose.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we do that all the time. You know, people have a bigger lawn and they're like, I want to increase the size of my flower beds or my landscaping because I don't want to mow as much, or I want to increase the size of my garden because my family's getting bigger and I want to, grow my own produce, maybe sell a little bit at the farmer's market. So great way to do that. Mm-hmm. If you had satisfaction killing off that grass, if you were to use the weed-free zone in your lawn, it's even faster. Because Roundup takes sometimes a week or so before the plants really start to die. If you use the weed-free zone, like say on some Morning Glory in your lawn, you can see it dying after about 4 hours.
That would be very satisfying.
It's quite satisfying, yes. Yeah, because most people despise the Morning Glory in their lawn. So they can make an application later that day. They can actually see it dying. Mm. And very, very satisfying to watch that work. Mm. So,
how do I choose the best type of weed color? I guess it depends on what I'm doing.
But depends on what you're going after. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So Roundup or Kills All are both the glyphosate based products. They will kill everything that you spray it on. The nice thing about that is they degrade out of the soil in less than a week. And so you can replant back in the area where you've sprayed within about 5 to 7 days. And so it's completely gone. Don't have to worry about it damaging any new plants. You can plant right back in that area, no problems. Selective weed killers like the Weed Free Zone or Weed Be Gone, if you're familiar with the Ortho Weed Be Gone product, those will just kill broadleaf weeds. So you can use them on turf, you can use it on your lawn, won't damage your lawn, but it kills all the other broadleaf weeds. Unfortunately, it kills vegetables and flowers and trees and shrubs as well too. So anything with the broadleaf that's not a grass, it will damage. And so you got to be a little careful with that. On the other side, there's also a selective grass herbicide that will just kill grass and won't kill your desirable plants. So you can actually use it in vegetables or flowers or raspberries or strawberries or ground cover, and it will kill the grass that has infiltrated into those areas without damaging the other plants. Mm. So there are some nice selective herbicides out there that will kill either broadleaf or just grasses instead of killing everything. So you use those very, very wisely and control a lot of weeds without damaging your desirable plants. Mm.
We just have a couple of minutes left with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden. Let's circle back to how we began the program. Remind me what I can plant right now that I could harvest before the
okay. So we've got we've got all your cold weather crops that can handle the cold through the fall. So we've got lettuces, spinach, radishes. You can start some onions for green onions and let them winter over and then have them develop into full onions next year as well too. So that's kind of fun. And mustards, kale, collards. Beet greens, you've got plenty of time to do all of those leafy greens through the fall. Prime time for planting garlic. I just got 14 varieties of different garlics in. So if you want to try some really fun different varieties of garlic, got probably 10, 11 varieties of hardneck and probably 3 or 4 varieties of softneck. Hardnecks, great flavor, richer flavor. Softnecks, a little bit better storage. They'll keep a little bit longer. And so a lot of different garlics to choose from. Got some great ones. Yugoslavian's good. The Ukraine's excellent. I really like German Red and Susan Delafield and Spanish Roja. There's a lot of great ones. So good time for planting garlic.
So some
too.
Good things we can do right
oh,
now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then, like I said, tulip bulbs are coming in. Great time for planting perennials and shrubs and trees. Until the ground freezes, you can just plant right up until about mid-November when that ground starts to turn hard and you can't dig it anymore.
Mark Anderson, Anderson Seed and Garden, has been with us, and we hope you'll join us next time for the Zesty Garden. Brian Earle, rested and relaxed from his vacation, will be back in the seat. Mark Anderson, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We'll take a brief break. When we come back, we'll have Petals and Prose with Helen Cannon.
The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
How do you manage work-life balance? For many of us, life seems to have two speeds, fast and faster. The pressures at work are followed by the needs and demands at home. A recent study found that more than half of American workers felt overwhelmed by their workload at some point. Even so, 1/3 of those surveyed had no plans to make the vacation days they had available. No matter how energetic you may be, stretching yourself to the limit every day puts your health and happiness at risk. Frequent stress takes a mental and physical toll on your body. If you are often stressed out, you may feel irritated, worried, or depressed, and may have frequent headaches, backaches, or an upset stomach. A wise goal is simply to do what you reasonably can. This will help you strive for a balance between your work and home activities. If you can also manage to take time for yourself every day, you'll be on the road to a greater well-being. This is Dana Barrett for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. For the last few times, I've been talking about plants and politics, and I used writings of Jamaica Kincaid, a writer from Antigua who very much resented the imposition of the British in Antigua of the kinds of gardens and plants that were not native to Antigua itself. And she writes a lot about that. I have a former student who lives in Bangalore, India, and I send him links to these programs. And he responded very affirmatively and endorsed Kincaid's resentment of what the British did when they came in to India and imposed their gardens. And he sent me a piece on the Taj Mahal about a book written by a man who researched and went back to how the gardens had been at the Taj Mahal before the British came. They had been native plants and almost like a forest, so that you came through it and suddenly there was the Taj Mahal. Most people can now visualize the very formal lawns and mirrored approach to the Taj Mahal. I thought I'd read just a little bit of this about the Taj. Today, the Taj, which draws millions of tourists a year, is surrounded by neat rectangles of manicured lawn. The gardens would have to be trimmed back, but those who saw them before spoke of how the greenery gradually revealed the mystery of the Taj's stunning facade. Homesick colonials left their imprint on India's parks and gardens, many of which are still full of tidy green lawns, trimmed hedges, and flower beds with British blooms. The British left a lasting horticultural mark on India, writes Herbert, whose book was compiled from letters and diaries of British colonialists. When the British first arrived in India in the 17th century, they discovered a continent brimming with strange but lush exotic flowers that made them yearn for their carefully tended gardens back home. And then he quotes from a letter, "The farther from home they ventured, the more they longed for the familiar cowslips and hollyhocks, Michaelmas daisies, for well-trimmed lawns and neat flower beds." In India, where outbreaks of malaria, dysentery, and other illnesses constantly brought death, many colonialists desired the comfort that a well-ordered garden could lend. The joy of recreating an English flower garden in a foreign landscape was recounted in rhapsodic terms by a military officer's wife in 1905. She writes, "My violets are in bloom." She wrote in a letter to her mother, "You cannot think how one treasures out here this quiet little home flower." Wherever the British went, Herbert notes, they took with them as part of their cultural baggage their love of gardens and their view about what a garden should look like. But the landscapes created by the British were a far cry from the extraordinary beauty of the Mughal gardens that the inspiration of the Taj Mahal is a stunning example. Despite such splendor, the British stamp on gardens remains in India. So Prashanta, my student, is very much in agreement with Jamaica Kincaid. I'm trying to use writers who had garden columns in papers or magazines. And Jamaica Kincaid had a column in The New Yorker. And this one about her feelings about the cold is quite entertaining, I think. "I always take this personally. I think frost is something someone is doing to me, only to me. And this is how winter in the garden begins, with another tentativeness, a curtsy to the actual cold to come, a gentle form of it. The effect of cold air on things growing in the garden is something I cannot get used to, cannot understand, even after so many years." She now lives in Vermont, by the way. "How can it be that after a frost, the entire garden looks as if it had been to a party in hell, as if it had been picked up and set down just outside the furnace of a baker's oven, and the oven door never shut? I must have been about 10 years old when I first came in contact with cold air. Where I lived, Antigua, the air was hot, and then hotter. And if sometimes, usually in December, the temperature at night got down to 75 degrees, you wore a sweater and a flannel blanket was put on the bed. Once the parents of a girl I knew got a refrigerator, and when they were not home, she asked me to come over and put my hand in the freezer. I was convinced then, and remain so now, that cold air is unnatural, man-made, associated with prosperity, refrigerators being common in the prosperous North, and more real, as the artificial always seems, and special than the warm air that was so ordinary to me. And then when I moved to the prosperous North, I became suspicious of cold air, because it also seemed associated with the dark. With the cold comes the dark. In the dark, things grow pale and die, and no explanation from science or nature of how the sun can shine brightly in the deep of winter has ever been satisfactory to me. In my heart, I know that the cold and the light, the winter and the summer, cannot be at the same time." In a chapter in her book, my garden book, Jamaica Kincaid writes about possible gifts that a gardener might give other gardeners. And one of the gifts she talks about is garden books. And she does know about Vita Sackville-West, the woman whose gardens I want to talk about. Huge and beautiful gardens, palatial gardens, and a castle, a real castle that the gardens lead to. And Jamaica Kincaid says, "I have been to Sissinghurst." That's the name of Vita's gardens. "I have read Jane Brown's Sissinghurst Portrait of a Garden. All of the great gardeners I know love this garden and everything connected to it, especially its creators, Vita Sackville-West and her husband. It is a beautiful garden, an extraordinary creation, and yet I remain unmoved by it, perhaps because I have read too much of Sackville-West's own writing. The best of her garden writing has been collected by Robin Lane Fox, an extraordinary gardener himself, in an anthology called The Illustrated Garden Book. I suspect that the source of my antipathy to Sackville-West and her garden is to be found in her observations of the garden, in the way she manages to be oblivious of the world. For the fact is, the world cannot be left out of a garden. At least I find that to be so, and that's why I regard Nina Simone's autobiography as an essential companion volume to my work, to any work by Vita Sackville-West. And then I'd like to turn to Vita's own writing and writing about her. For nearly 15 years, Vita Sackville-West enchanted the readers of the Observer newspaper with her weekly column on gardening. Writers on gardening need two very different skills. They must be able to garden and also to write. Vita Sackville West had been a writer since her youth, a poet, novelist, and biographer. She and her husband, Harold Nicholson, had already made The Great Garden at Sissinghurst Castle in Kent. Her readers knew she was busy with ideas and that the ideas she suggested and wrote it with authority of a great garden maker and planter. She also contrived a style, a simple personal tone, with literary allusions and an artful air of romance. Thousands of non-gardeners read her pieces until she stopped because they were so good. There had never been such a gardening column until she stopped in 1961. Her readers gave weekly proof of it. They wrote to her. They sent her seeds, ideas, and presents. When she sent plants in reply, they thanked her in romantic idiom, which seemed appropriate. In rationed post-war Britain, they sent her knickknacks for her garden, advice on how to keep the sparrows off the primroses, and requests for inspiration with their own designs. When she wrote enthusiastically about an unusual strawberry tree, the post office had to send a special van to Sissinghurst in order to deliver the bags of readers' inquiries. And so I'd like to give you a feeling of Vita's own writing. This very short book is very personal and therefore very arbitrary. It represents nothing more than a couple of dozen among the plants I like to grow in my own garden. And at first sight, it may seem that there are no connecting links in this choice of plants at all. I hope I can explain that there are. The book is addressed not to the professional, but to the amateur gardener. This country is a country of garden lovers, and it contains many who, getting perhaps a little bored with growing exactly the same things as their neighbors year after year, look round for a few extras which shall come well within the scope of their purse, time, and knowledge. We can all grow our wallflowers, lupins, delphiniums, or snapdragons. Far be it from me to run down any of these valuable allies, but the moment always comes when the taste of every true flower lover turns towards something less usual and obvious. It is this type of gardener that I have in mind. Although each of the flowers I have chosen to describe is comparatively easy to grow and inexpensive to buy, it has, I think, a quality of its own and is something which is not always seen in every garden. And then, because of Brian and his love for irises, I'll read just a little bit of her garden column on Iris reticulata. When flowers come so thick in summer that one hesitates which to pick among them so many, one is apt to forget the bare cold days when the earth is a miser, offering only one or two. Take it or leave it. Wrapped in mufflers and overcoats, we go and peer about for a stray sprig of winter sweet, a splashed and muddy hellebore, a premature violet, anything to fill one solitary glass with some pretense of spring long before spring has really arrived. There are the bulbs, of course, which one has carefully plunged in ashes or placed in a dark cupboard according to the instructions in the garden books and catalogs. But somehow, there is always something a little artificial about any flower which has been compelled to bloom before its time. Even though we may not number ourselves among the rich who languidly fill their rooms on an order to a florist with lilacs at Christmas and tulips on New Year's Day, there is still, I think, a great difference between flowers which we force and those which we have the patience to wait for in their proper season. For one thing, the forced flower always slightly spoils our delight in its indoor successor when it normally arrives. And for another, the forced flower itself, however welcome, is always something of a fake. To the lover of flowers, these arguments are disturbing, disturbingly potent. The moral of all this is that we especially welcome any flower which lightens the gloom of winter of its own accord. The more fragile and improbable looking, the better. Such a flower is Iris reticulata. It seems extraordinary that anything so gay, delicate, and brilliant should really prefer the rigors of winter to the amenities of spring. It is true that we can grow Iris reticulata in pots under glass if we wish to do so, and that the result will be extremely satisfying and pretty. But far more pleasing is the virtue of Iris reticulata that will come into bloom out of doors as early as February, with no coddling or forcing at all. Purple flecked with gold, it will open its buds even above the snow. The ideal place to grow it is in a pocket, rather rich, though well-drained soil, amongst stones, a private place which it can have all to itself for the short but grateful days of its consummation. Iris reticulata, the netted iris, not the flowers netted, but the bulb. The bulb wears a little fibrous coat like a miniature fishing net. It is a native of the Caucasus, and there is a curious fact about it. The Caucasian native is reddish, whereas the European garden form is the true imperial purple. Botanists, including W.R. Dykes, the greatest authority on irises, have been puzzled by the Mendelian characteristics exhibited by this group. Mr. Dykes received bulbs from the Caucasus, which were always reddish. The garden form was purple, and yet the seedlings raised from the garden form were always reddish again. It was only the fourth generation, raised from seed, that he obtained the purple form, and even that differed slightly in color from the fixed garden type. It is unlikely that any of us will wish to experiment with our own saved seeds in this way, but I still throw it out as a suggestion to those who have the inclination and the leisure. Let me warn those enthusiasts that they will have to wait at least 4 years between the sowing of the seed and the flowering of the bulb. In the meantime, I do suggest that every flower lover should grow a patch of little reticulata somewhere in his garden. Let me also draw his attention to the variety known as reticulata contab, rather expensive at present, which is a bright blue gentian blue. However, being an expensive treasure, it is better grown in a pot under glass. It would be a pity to buy it and then lose it. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producers Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Waste not. Fertilizers and yard waste, such as grass clippings or leaves that are swept down our storm drains, contribute to the amount of nutrients in our rivers and lakes. The increased nutrient levels can harm fish and other wildlife. We can improve water quality by sweeping up fertilizers and clippings off our sidewalks and driveways to prevent them from running into storm drains.
Waste not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.